Okay. So, first of all, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. So just to start off, like I just this is please don't like take this. I just want to get to know you and like the work that you do. And also, I am a little sick, so if I like cough in the middle and just like I'm so sorry about that.
Do not apologize. I am also kind of under the weather. I just traveled yesterday and now I just feel kind of yucky. Just I always get this way after I travel, even pre-COVID, but yeah, totally fine.
Yeah. So, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in activism?
I was born and raised in South Mississippi on the Gulf Coast. And I definitely think that where I was raised, in addition to the identities I held, kind of just had a major impact in pushing me towards advocacy. Growing up as a black queer person and, at the time a woman, it meant that I had to like counter a lot of different things at several different points in my life. I was also, and still am, a really, really huge introvert. But when I was in high school, I joined my school's speech and debate team. And that really kind of put me on that road to feeling more comfortable about speaking my opinion. I started to realize that I actually am really passionate about these things, and even though having debates and talking to people makes me nervous, it was really important to talk about some of these issues. And so that was kind of where I started to get more comfortable with using my voice, and advocacy kind of just naturally followed after that.
Okay, so you talked about like different experiences that you experienced because of the identities you held. Could you talk a little bit more about that if you're comfortable? Also, at any point, if you feel like you don't want to answer a question or if you feel uncomfortable, please just let me know.
Oh, yeah, I totally will. Thank you so much for saying that. I appreciate that you're being so conscious of that. But yeah, I'm comfortable talking about it. I have it's a vague memory, but it's one that's still that I remember pretty clearly, if that makes sense. But right before I started going to school, so I was like 4 or 5 years old, right before kindergarten, my mom started to have, that kind of talk with me about the fact that I should love people regardless of their skin color and to always love everyone, like not to judge people. But she also warned me that people would be judging me because of my skin color as a black person, especially in Mississippi. And I say especially in Mississippi, but in reality, racism is a problem everywhere. I just think that people feel a little bit more bold and they don't hide it as much in Mississippi. But regardless, back to what I was saying, when I was in kindergarten, literally 5 years old, there was this, young woman, young kid in my class that I wanted to be friends with because we were five, we're in kindergarten. We want to make friends and talk to people. And she essentially told me that we couldn't be friends because her white father, and she was white as well, told her that black people were evil and criminals and just really bad people, and that she can't be friends with anyone that's black. And that obviously really affected me, so I like ran home crying to my mom, and she made a huge scene in the principal's office, as she should have, about how it's not okay for, this kid to be going around saying these things and the effect that it's having on the classroom environment and obviously a student here. And that was kind of my first encounter with racism. And then just growing up throughout school, I was always kind of a teacher's pet because, again, I was an introvert, didn't really talk to anyone. And so there were times where I wanted to like help out with things like moving a couple boxes, helping rearrange the classroom. And I was always told that I couldn't because I was a girl and I should let the boys do it. Which at the time, it was like, I can do anything. It doesn't matter if I'm a girl. But at the same time, in the back of my head, I didn't fully understand what it meant to be a girl and like why that made me inherently different from the boys. And so that kind of just sent me down the spiral of my figuring out my gender identity. And so it was kind of just an amalgamation of all these different, like, relatively, I guess, what should have seemed tiny kind of had like a big domino effect, if that makes sense.
It really does. It does make sense. Can't imagine having to experience that at such a young age. It would affect a person.
Yeah, it was intense. It was a memory that I kind of blocked out for a while until I started to reflect more seriously on my life as I was growing up about how, like, especially as of recent times when people are starting to discuss, like, how young is too young to talk about racism? And it's like, you know, people of color, children of color have to be taught about racism before they even leave the house for the first time because they have to be warned about how the world is going to treat them. And that's not fair.
Not fair in any context ever. I wish it wasn't. But what area of activism excites you the most, or like that you focus on the most?
The area I definitely focus on the most is reproductive justice, and very closely underneath that, sex education. I originally got to reproductive justice through my work with sex education. When I was a senior in high school, I had applied to join this group called the Mississippi Youth Council that was operated by this nonprofit called Teen Health Mississippi. And through that, I had started to, you know, reflect and learn a lot about the fact that Mississippi's sex education policies, you know, are deeply ineffective and aren't helping the way that they think they are, and in fact are not helping at all, actually, and the ways in which they are can be deeply sexist and racist and all these other factors, and how much they're deeply harming communities. And shortly after I began to volunteer with them, or I was getting, you know, stipends for the work, but shortly after I began working with them, I also started to volunteer with Planned Parenthood of Mississippi, who I didn't know that we even had a Planned Parenthood of Mississippi until I was a senior in high school. But I started to volunteer with them, and I was like canvassing and phone banking and learning all these the history of abortion and all the different laws that affect the ability to access abortion in Mississippi. And so as I was like continuing on this work and like, you know, learning about, it started with sex education is very, or sex education that is based in abstinence is ineffective at treating, or ineffective at reducing like STI rates in young adults, and also doesn't effectively teach young adults about how to handle relationships and make healthy choices about their sexual lives. And then it evolved into realizing that, you know, abstinence-based sex education tends to be more based in communities with more Black people and more people of color, and white communities tend to get comprehensive sex education and access to these resources. And then learning that abortion access, you know, we have to fight for it a lot, but especially communities of color and low-income communities have to fight for it. And so when all these different identities and like the experiences of lived people began to intersect at these issues to be bigger than they actually are, that's when I began to study reproductive justice, and it just became kind of my mission in life because of all the different factors and issues that fall underneath it. It's something that I feel like if we were to achieve it, the world would be a much better place.
Absolutely. I recently read an article that talked about how communities of color have to fight for the choice of abortion rather than the right of abortion because of socioeconomic and other factors. Would you agree that through your work, like that is very prominent? Or would you say like other factors are at play in reproductive justice and like the intersection of color communities?
Yeah, there are definitely like a lot of different factors at play, but I think that the choice is having the choice is probably the correct language to be using. Because, even for, because yes, people still have the right legally to access abortion, but it's not really an aspect of having the right if, a person of color can't, for example, in Mississippi, take, time off work to be out, to be able to travel to the one abortion clinic that we have in the state to have someone to watch children if they already have them, because most people getting abortions already have children. Having to, pay for the abortion, and there's all these different factors that are preventing them from being able to access this right, So it's not about the right, it's about having the choice and the ability to get one. And I also think that for a lot of communities, especially communities of color, it could definitely be an issue of, social ostracization because of like teachings of religion or culture, and just ultimately comes down to all these different factors that are trying to control the decisions that other people make over their bodies. That, they're really hard to fight against, and just they have, gosh, I get so upset thinking about it because it's not fair that so many people don't get to just make this choice about their lives because of all the different pressures and factors and barriers that are that they're up against, some that have been there for generations.
I'm so sorry.
You're fine.
Can you talk more about like social ostracization that you talk about in communities?
It's especially when you grow up, I think that specifically growing up as a person of color in America, our communities like tend to stick together, because that's how kind of how we're able to like find our support system and our support group in a really white dominated society. It's not necessarily a fear of white people, but the apprehension of, I don't know if I can trust you just yet. That's kind of just laying underneath the surface. So we tend to kind of flock together to people that look like us and who we think we can trust because, we don't think they're gonna perpetuate racism against us. And within these communities, especially when we are taught a lot of things which were kind of pushed onto our communities, usually by like colonization, especially religion, it can definitely result in, if you don't act and behave a certain type of way, then, you're an outsider, you're going to be treated that way. And it's definitely something that can be an issue, especially for somebody seeking abortion care, because they have been taught that like what is the right thing to do in the eyes of God and all these different or like you can't take away one of our future community members or different language like that that's meant to like guilt trip this person into keeping and sustaining a pregnancy that they do not want. And I think a lot of people tend to forget that pregnancy isn't just 9 months and then it's over with. It's 9 months of constant hormonal and body changes, and then potentially for years after that, potentially dealing with postpartum depression and all the other emotional, hormonal, and physical after effects of having a baby. And so it's, there's just all this pressure for people, especially I feel like within communities of color who have grown up within religion or like cultural standards of, wanting to contribute to the community, that I feel like also put a lot of pressure on people to have children that they may not want to have, which it can also present itself in the opposite effect as well, because reproductive justice isn't about abortion, it's about having the right to have children and to not have children. And I feel like there are also a lot of, there's a lot of ostracization for people who do choose to have children. You know, they're told that they are too young or too old, or they don't make enough money, or they don't have the right environment to raise a kid in. And that can also lead to ostracization as well. You know, it's like, no matter what choice you make, people are going to judge you. And we should definitely be working to build like a community environment where people are feel safe and loved and supported in any decision they choose to make about their pregnancy.
Absolutely. So speaking of like vocabulary and how vocabulary impacts like how the movement is viewed, or how like people, like how vocabulary impacts people, how do you think the reproductive justice framework can be improved to be more inclusive? Like, the popular narrative related to pregnancies, often like people use terms like, or like usually the most common term is woman or like mothers, but women and or mothers aren't always the parents or birth givers or people who can be pregnant. How do you think that can be incorporated into like the reproductive justice framework, or just generally in the conversation?
It starts with listening to trans people, gender non-conforming people, and non-binary people, and people who don't identify on the gender binary. It's definitely something that is becoming a bigger issue, especially with abortion beginning to take like front and center stage with all the different state cases and Supreme Court cases coming up. But I think that the language we use is really, really important. Especially as a non-binary person, I've experienced pregnancy before. I am not a woman, but I still deserve the choice to be able to get an abortion if I choose to get one. And I think that the language that we're using, it's important at the, you know, first of all, for respecting the identities of people who may need to get this care, and understanding that their experience is different than our own. But I feel like it also has a deeper level that some people aren't necessarily anticipating yet, and that's that anti-choice and more conservative, like, voters and people and judges and lawyers. We have to be careful about the language that we're using, because it can so easily be manipulated by those people. And, you know, there is this fear in the back of my mind that if we continue writing this legislation and these Supreme Court cases and advocacy material centering women and mothers, that we're putting ourselves at risk of potentially, like, you know, if I can see it pretty much, I can see it happening that the conservative movement decides to, you know, if women get the right to access abortion, let's attack them somewhere else. So, you know, legally, if the law only says woman, can a person who has an X on their, you know, official government certified identification, like their driver's license, can they access abortion still? Are they protected under this? And it's also important in the long term, because it's not just going to be women obtaining abortions. You know, doctors and providers need to be taught the proper language and terminology to use when talking to their patients, because if they're talking to a non-binary person or a trans person or anyone who doesn't identify as a woman or who isn't, you know, cis, they have to use the right language and, the and you know, be and have the ability to really have a sense of care and empathy in their language when they're discussing with these patients, because, I mean, the experiences that we have in healthcare can affect whether we go back to the doctor for the rest of our lives. And it's important that we be so mindful of that, because it can have huge effects. I mean, and it's really just as simple as saying pregnant people, pregnant person, people who give birth. It's not that hard of a terminology leap, and I think it's important to discuss the fact that women tend to be the target of these issues. Yes, that's absolutely 100% true, but there are also millions of other people who aren't women who will be affected by these issues as well. And I think using an isolationist lens is just not good. I think it's important to bring intersectionality to everything.
Absolutely. How do you think, so going back to when you talked about your involvement with sex education and the lack of a proper curriculum for sex education within Mississippi and the lack of the intersectional lens in teaching that, how do you think that can be improved? And I think, like you said, it's kind of like a domino effect how it kind of starts off. I feel like sex education is really important in how it helps everyone view reproductive justice through a intersectional lens. So how do you, through your experience and your work, how do you think that impacts reproductive justice?
So how sex education affects reproductive justice?
Yes, I'm sorry, I kind of just
No, you're good. It's because it starts with the fact that, well, part of reproductive justice's definition is the right to personal bodily autonomy. And that includes not just the right to, I think, to access abortion or anything like that, but I think it also includes personal bodily autonomy of who you choose to have sex with, who you choose to not have sex with, what kind of sex you choose to have, and just all the personal decisions that people make regarding their body and sex all the time. And people don't know what choices are available to them if you don't teach them. And currently, within sex education, at least in Mississippi, the teachers aren't required to teach about consent. And the law kind of specifically specifies that it's important to emphasize that, like, basically the only type of correct sex is sex that takes place after marriage between a man and a woman. So when we have sex education that is abstinence only, that teaches that sex is only between a man and a woman who are married, and that's like the only way to prevent STIs and unwanted pregnancy. We are constructing a framework in which people are not able to see themselves outside of it. Or at least if they do see themselves outside of that framework, they see it as if they're doing something inherently wrong and may not even choose to live as their best self because of it. So having like comprehensive sex education that gets to consent and teaching personal boundaries, and having comprehensive sex education also means having conversations about how, yes, there are people who have sex that involves a penis and vagina, but there are also people who have sex who both have penises, who both have vaginas, who are both intersex. And having those conversations and teaching people about their bodies and being able to identify what feels good and what doesn't, that's really important for people to know what choices are available to them when it comes to being able to control their body. And comprehensive sex education gets not just to sex, but also to like healthy relationships and dating violence and healthy communication skills. And I think that all that is important to be able to achieve reproductive justice because people have to know the options that are available to them and to be able to know that it's okay for them to say no, that it's okay if they're not straight, it's okay if they're not monogamous even. It ultimately just gets to being able to help people understand that there are a world of options before them and they are open to be able to making any choices that they want, as long as the choices are healthy and uplift them and it's something that they want and that makes them happy. If we can't get to reproductive justice if we keep teaching people that they have to be monogamous, that, their a slut or similar to a used piece of gum, which is something that they use in some classes, is they pass around a piece of gum and then ask a person at the end of the class if they would like to eat that piece of gum and then compare it to a person who's had sex with multiple partners. Stuff like that, it prevents us from like socially, culturally, and legally being able to change the narrative about sex and personal bodily autonomy.
Absolutely. That's just wrong on so many levels and just changes how people can know what choices they have.
Yeah, and it's also just an element of further like social ostracization by being able to teach children that, oh, this person, they are used, they're nasty, they're, all this horrible language, which of course has a bigger effect of people aren't going to be able to have honest conversations with their doctors about their health because they feel like they're going to be shamed for it.
So you created your own major in college called Reproductive Justice and Advocacy. Can you tell me a little bit about how you came to that and how you want to use that further?
I can try to answer this best that I can. I unfortunately don't attend that school anymore, so that's not my major anymore, unfortunately. But I do see myself, and I would like to return to this school to finish that degree in the future. So now my credits are good for like 10 plus years, or at least 10 years. But I came to it because at the time at the school, my major was public policy. And the best way to put it is that I kind of got really tired of discussing like what issues, not issues I didn't feel weren't important, but they just weren't sparking my interest. I got very bogged down by having to read the theory and philosophy of a bunch of old white men who were most likely and were racist and or sexist and every other ism under the sun. It wasn't interesting to me, and I ultimately felt like, we didn't need their philosophy and their theory to be able to have these conversations about legality and making sure that we build ethical laws or anything like that. And to be honest, I also don't want to take the framework for somebody who is sexist or racist. And I was also at a point where I just didn't know if school was working for me. I was and still am working all the time, and so it was like, if I'm going to be in school, I want to learn about things that are actually important to me. And I saw that there just wasn't really a major at my school that was fitting me and my interest. And I remembered that we had an individualized studies program where you could build your own major. You completely choose all of your own classes and everything. And so I, talked to a graduate student within the department who kind of helps you out with that, with building your major and selecting your classes. And after talking to them, and I went through all of the class lists that we potentially had available at my university, so I scrolled through the entire class catalog, I realized that there was enough for me to make a major, with classes that could help someone with being able to build and understand a reproductive justice framework and how to achieve it. And so I had three concentrations. One was in, I personally wanted to just call it health and history, but I was pushed to call it women's health and history, which I didn't want to do. I very much wanted to keep a gender neutral perspective in my major. And my advisors basically kind of pushed me towards being able, towards saying women and being specific about it, which I didn't really appreciate. But anyway, so there's a section on women's health and identity, which includes classes in child and maternal health, classes in LGBTQ health, and also classes about various ways that, women have had a role in like history, whether that's the civil rights movement or the women's rights movement, just all classes like that. Another concentration was a concentration on policy and advocacy. So that included classes on social movements and how they inspire change, and also on how to create morally and ethically minded laws and policy. And the concentration that I was really excited for and that I had to fight the most for was a class on the criminal justice system and policing. The concentration on criminal justice and policing, which included classes about policing, the effects they have on the community, and also classes discussing racism within policing, and also covering the ways in which we can try to solve issues without the police, which, as I've started to grow more in my advocacy, abolition and prison, like prison and police abolition, has become a very central focal point for me, because I feel like it's a very, very huge aspect of reproductive justice that, if we don't achieve it, people will never be able to have personal bodily autonomy or to raise their children in healthy and sustainable communities. And so ultimately, what I hope to do with that is to fight for reproductive justice in any way that I can. I'm definitely still figuring out my place in the movement and where I can inspire the most change and also help the most people that I can. But I think that being able to be armed with all this knowledge about creating change and the facts about the healthcare system and what's happening and the history of where we've been and how policing plays into all of it would be very central to being able to, fight for reproductive justice.
That's an interesting. I've never thought about the intersection of policing or abolishing prison and how that would work with reproductive justice. Could you talk a little bit more about that, please?
Yeah, of course. The definition of reproductive justice, being able to maintain personal bodily autonomy to have or to not have children and to raise these children in safe and sustainable communities. That kind of definition and framework is incompatible with a society that has police or a prison system. Starting with the fact that people who are in prison do not have personal bodily autonomy. And that starts with the fact that they're locked in a cage that they don't have the choice to leave. But also gets into the deeper level of the fact that a lot of people, once they're put into prison, they lose their personal bodily autonomy on a deeper level because of how they are communicated with. I watched a live stream documentary about this called Belly of the Beast, that was about the women's prison system in California and how so many people have been sterilized without their knowledge within these prison systems, because doctors either hadn't fully explained the procedure, they kind of just gave them paperwork for them to sign without fully saying what they were going to be doing. And this also happened especially to immigrant women who were detained and who didn't speak English, so they had no idea what procedure was being done on them. And many of these people didn't find out until after they had left prison that they had even been sterilized. And then getting into the aspect of having or not having children and being able to raise these children. When people are put into prison, they are taken away from their children and from their community. If you're in prison, you don't have the right to be there to raise your children and to have a voice in how they're being raised. And then it's also the fact of thinking about safe and sustainable communities. Police do not create a safe and sustainable community. They are often in communities to cause terror and fear, and people can't raise their children safely in a heavily policed community. because I know that for a lot of people of color, especially Black people specifically, there's this fear of having your child go out into the world on their own for the first time, because a lot of people are afraid that their child may not come back home, because it could be as simple as, you know, thinking about specific cases that happened, but just walking back home with a bag of Skittles or playing with a BB gun like almost every other child does in a public park, you know, those kids didn't get to go home because their community wasn't safe. And not even just the aspect of them potentially being killed by the police, but them being detained by the police and having to go through the court system at such a young age. That's another instance where people have their children taken away from them and just not having to have a choice in how they're being raised or what's happening with their care, because they've been, you know, now forced into like the school to prison pipeline. It's just ultimately a community with prison and policing, it's incredibly harmful, especially when we begin to think about the fact that people are being, or have been for generations, you know, tried and convicted and put in prison for their pregnancy outcomes. So, you know, people who have had miscarriages even being sent to prison because of like child neglect, or having a miscarriage and it being categorized as an abortion, and being sent to prison, and the ways in which we criminalize people who are, or people who use drugs and who also are pregnant, have the punishment lens that we use in our society does nothing to provide care and community to people who need it. You know, people who use drugs and are pregnant, they do not need criminalization and punishment. They need support and care from their community. And, you know, just prison and policing are just the complete antithesis of reproductive justice. And even if we were to achieve a full world with comprehensive sex education, you know, full access to abortion on demand, full access to birth control on demand, all these different things, we would still have a world of policing and prison there, completely preventing people from being able to raise their children however they want. They're sterilizing people and taking away their bodily autonomy, and creating communities that are not safe and sustainable, but are instead filled with fear and anxiety, and just ultimately communities that are ripped apart because of policing and prisons. And so it's really, we can't really get to one or get to reproductive justice without also removing the barrier and the prison industrial, of the prison industrial complex and policing.
Thank you so much for sharing that. That, while I knew like these two aspects existed, I never thought of the intersection of that before. Thank you so much for educating me on that. How do you believe?
Yeah, it's a problem.
How do you believe social media plays a role in how we can, do you think we could use social media in a positive way or a negative way, or perhaps like amplifying in like amplifying a movement or just educating everyone about a movement?
Yeah, social media is super critical, I think, especially to social movements, you know, of right now and of the future, because I don't know when the internet's going away. I guess when climate change finally ends the earth. At my current school that I'm at, I am majoring in digital audiences and justice studies. And so part of that is that I'm also having to take classes on interdisciplinary thought and how two different disciplines can be used to like create a solution. And so I actually just recently had to do a paper kind of justifying why I chose to major in digital audiences and justice studies and how I think I can integrate the two in my career, and really beginning to learn more about how the internet works and how things are marketed and how to create a successful campaign and all these different issues, Obviously, it's probably mostly there for people who are there for marketing and business, but I'm thinking about it from the social justice aspect and how we can use social media to uplift these movements. And the fact is that social media has connected us unlike any way before. We can get access to millions of people's stories, whether they're in California or the Bronx or in the Philippines or in just anywhere. And I think that social media, it's one of the ultimate ways to break down the like educational barriers that exist for so many people. Because for a lot of people, they may want to know about these issues, or these issues may even be affecting them. But because of academia and all those institutional educational barriers, they may not have a full understanding of these issues. And so having a social media platform like Instagram or Twitter to be able to post about, for instance, a Texas abortion ban, that allows us to reach millions of people and allows us to be able to break down like complicated and complex legal issues into ways that people can understand, into like a 280 character tweet or into a Instagram carousel post, to be able to break down these issues. And even if you're not making the post directly on social media, it can even be used to amplify your Zoom webinar where you're talking about these issues. And I think it will be a very great tool for liberation, because there are just so many people who will not be able to fully understand or even know about these issues. But almost everyone, a lot of people, have social media. And so being able to use it as a platform to not only educate about these issues, but also to be able to use it to amplify about events or protests or rallies, using it as an organizing tool, and also being able to reach people where they are. And, maybe a person across the country attends your webinar about the state of abortion access in Alabama, but it's pulled them to be able to show up to their abortion clinic, to be a clinic escort. I talk about the domino effect a lot, but it's very real. And I think that social media is really showing that effect to us, because the power that we've been able to build off of it. I mean, the Women's March was a very, white cis-centered event, but it still had millions of people across the country turn up to DC or into marches in their home states. And that ultimately comes down to the power of social media and being able to amplify your message and your movement there. And I can see it building for prison abolition and police abolition. It has an ebb and flow, sadly, but I think that having social media, especially after the murder of George Floyd, it became an avenue like never before, I think, for education and being able to talk to people about these issues, because they couldn't get away from it. It was everywhere. And I think that's definitely a tactic that we need to continue to use to raise awareness about these issues. Because even if people don't want to learn, or they want to try to ignore it, it's really hard to do that if everywhere you open on Instagram, social, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube is talking about it. And I think that's ultimately going to be the way where we're able to break down this like academia barrier that's kept so many people from participating in these issues.
Absolutely. So while doing the work that you do, and like just being involved in the movement in general, did you ever face any pushback, whether it was from your family, community, or anyone within the movement, or just anyone in general? And if you did, how'd you handle that?
I definitely have. My family definitely, they were definitely very afraid for me. They were proud of me, but they're also very afraid. They wanted me to be very careful about, they were telling me not to post about it. They would sometimes tell me, don't go to this event, or can you just skip this one, or can you take those stickers off of your car? Which my mom actually did. When I moved away to DC, I came back and all of my stickers, which I had like some stickers about, I think about abortion care and like about LGBTQ, you know, equality or whatever, and they were gone off of my car. And so I definitely had my family push back against me on participating in some things because they're worried about my safety, which wasn't unfounded. Sadly, there are many activists who still go missing and are never heard from again, because that's advocacy is not just posting on social media. And even though that, for a lot of people, that is their form of activism, and I do acknowledge the ways in which that's also like healthy for people, especially like it's a much more accessible form of advocacy for people who may not be able to show up to protests and rallies and things like that. But I specifically mean people who just post about the issue and move on and think that that's it and that's their advocacy. Because for a lot of people, they are putting their lives on the line by talking about these issues. Thankfully, when I started my advocacy work, I found a community of other activists and people doing real work who showed up to support me and help me grow. You know, at 17 years old, that was just, I would not be where I am now if I didn't have those people supporting me and believing in me as a young person to be able to use my voice and have an opinion on these issues and be able to make change. But the safety aspect was definitely a very real one. Shortly before I moved to DC in 2019, this group called Sons of the Confederacy, basically, members of the KKK had been threatening, you know, fellow activists that I work with and, you know, leaving threatening flyers at their door and all other types of things. But the Sons of the Confederacy then started doing this, like, discussing within their group about how, you know, if we don't shut up about these issues, they are going to essentially dox us. They were going to, you know, make it public, our email addresses, our phone numbers, our addresses. And they're talking about how it was within their freedom of speech to be able to discuss these issues. And, you know, we can show up outside these people's houses to protest and say whatever we want because they can't stop us. And at the time, I definitely tried to laugh it off and be like, oh, look at these, like, you know, these people on Facebook just typing behind their keyboards. They're not going to actually do anything. And when I had jokingly, you know, mentioned it to a mentor of mine, she was instantly concerned. And I don't know if it was just me using humor as a mechanism, but I was like, no, it's fine. They're not going to do anything. But the reality is that they could. And that's definitely been a real fear for me, is that I never want my family to get dragged into things or for them to potentially face consequences from the work that I do. But I also know that the work that I do is too real to give up. And if that puts my life at risk, like, so be it. I think that it's important to find passion and to find something that you are just as willing to die for as you are willing to live for it. And that's sadly something that I've had to come to terms with. And it also, like, pushes me that this work is necessary. If people are willing to kill me for it or to, like, put my safety at risk or to threaten me for it, then it's something that I can't stop, because we're fighting against systems that are much bigger than we are, but we have to destroy them in order to reach liberation and to materially change the lives of millions of people. So the pushback that I've received from my family, the pushback from the opposition, you know, even like after leading a walkout in my high school after the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting, having people say that we need to sit down and shut up and be in class and, you know, all these other things. I think the pushback just means that we're on the right path.
Absolutely. So you talked about like facing pushback in high school when like you walked out for like the Margaret Douglas shooting and how youth in general just face a lot of pushback from adults. So how can like youths who want to be involved in social justice movement, how can they be more involved? What's a piece of advice you have for them?
I think the best piece of advice is to honestly find someone who believes in you, and a mentor in that field, and somebody who is willing to help uplift your voice and teach you. I definitely believe in the power of young people being able to do things on their own. Absolutely, 100%. But I also think that our elders and the people who've been doing this work before us have a lot of education and things that they can impart on us. And not only that, but they can also help us get access to the resources that we need to be able to make the change that we want to do, or to learn more about these issues, or to participate more in them. And that can be done by, finding a local chapter that's doing the work that you want to be doing, whether that's a local chapter of your NAACP, in abortion fund in your state, a group in your state that's doing work on sex education or abortion access or on policing. It starts with reaching out and just figuring out who is going to help you, who is going to be your ally in this. Because it's building allyship and connections and relationships with each other. That's the way to get through this work. Not just for having power in numbers, but also because we need that support system to be able to do this work. Self-care during in advocacy and in this difficult work is so important, because burnout will make you stop. And not just that, but feeling defeated will make you stop. But self-care and taking care of yourself and believing in yourself, that's also a form of advocacy, because the opposition, racism, the patriarchy, all of it wants us to be defeated. It wants us to not care for ourselves and to not love ourselves. But through connections with others, that's how we get there. And especially if you're a young person starting this work, it's important to have that support network. And being able to figure out who's going to be there to support you. For me, that mentorship started with Teen Health Mississippi, and it started with Planned Parenthood Southeast, because there are adults in there who believed in my power as a young person, who saw potential in me, and who saw the value that I brought to the movement space. And I think that those people exist everywhere. We just have to find them. And it also shouldn't be about us having to find them. I think that adults and other people in the movement space should be reaching out to young people, because ultimately we have to sustain the movement. And that requires us pulling in younger, newer voices, not just because of their age, but also because of the perspective they can offer that may not have existed before. And so I just think it's really important for young people to know that they have value, their opinions matter, the potential that they have matters, the resources that they have and what they know, the knowledge they have and their perspective and their lived experiences matter, and they have value to this movement. And yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing everything that you did. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
It was no problem. Thank you for reaching out to me. I think that this project sounds absolutely amazing. I honestly would love to know like how you came to it.
Absolutely. So, Ashley, so this is like part of this class that I'm taking with this program at Duke. And it focuses on human rights. And I think I've just been, like, before coming to Duke, I wasn't very aware of a lot of, like, social justice movements and just issues outside of my immediate community. And I think, like, learning about, like, the different intersections of, like, different movements, and, like, that's just been very eye-opening. Like, I wish people could learn more about, like, everyone could just know about, like, the different intersections and how, like, all the different movements work.
Yeah, that's so important. I thank you for doing this because I
Thank
mean, this
you for
is
doing
huge.
this. I'm not doing anything. Thank you.
No, this is so huge. I this is also like a very, I think, huge part of the movement as well as being able to document it in ways like this because again, it ultimately comes down to education and putting these things like in every space that we can, that people can access them and learn about them. And, you know, thank you for the part that you're playing in being able to document this and like get people's lived experiences.
Absolutely. Again, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Wasn't a problem at all. I look forward to, you know, seeing everyone else's stories, you know, when you get the final project out.
Absolutely. I'll be sure to share it with you.
Yeah, thank you so much.